And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Okay, here's today's final Jeopardy question. What do Wordsworth, Rachel Carson, John Muir, E.F. Schumacher, Aldo Leopold, Teddy Goldsmith, Gerald Durrell, and Terry Tempest Williams have in common? And here's the answer to today's final Jeopardy question. Who are some of the world's leading nature and environmental writers? Ever wanted to be a nature writer? You'll find out what it takes when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Nature and the environment are in the news. Whether it be stampeding elephants in India, the drought in the American Southeast, mountaintop removal protecting turtle eggs on Mexico's shoreline, and we won't even mention global warming, clean energy, ocean bottom trawling, new Chinese coal plants, nature is the emerging big story on the planet. And what's needed right now are lots and lots of new writers to tell the stories. Today, we talk with Wendy Holtkamp, a working nature and environmental writer and journalist who shares some basic knowledge on what's involved in getting your stories published. We'll be talking with her in segment two, following a special news. In segment one, this segment, we bring you the weekly Earth Summit and then get an update from Donna Buckby, who has been feeding us reports from Rushford, Minnesota, about the recovery efforts underway in the small Midwestern town that was severely flooded just 2 months ago. With homes and businesses destroyed and winter coming on, how are things coming along? You'll find out. But first, the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. We begin today's summit with some good news from Carl Pope, president of the Sierra Club. Carl?
For decades, American Electric Power and other utilities broke the law. They refused to install pollution control equipment required by the Clean Air Act. So in 1999, the Sierra Club sued AEP, charging it had failed to modernize 46 coal-fired power units, mostly in the Ohio Valley, including three of America's dirtiest power plants. The Bush administration tried to bail AEP out with its misnamed Clear Skies rule that would have legalized the failure to clean up. When Congress said no, the case was set for trial, consolidated with other cases filed by states, environmental groups, even the Justice Department. This month, AEP admitted it had broken the law. It agreed to spend $4.6 billion cleaning up. This is good news for air quality in the Midwest and Northeast. Millions of pounds of pollutants will be kept out of the air. But it's also a reminder, without a tough environmental cop on the beat, there will always be companies that break the law to save money.
Thank you, Carl. Our next guest is Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, who reminds us of the importance of wild waters. Dr. Lovejoy?
One of the interesting things that really needs to be redressed is the way we think of parts of this living planet as inanimate. You know, we think of water as something that basically comes out of a faucet or runs down a river. We don't really think about fresh water as home to a whole variety of living things that only make their living in fresh water, whether it be some of the magnificent mayfly larvae, which build little castles of different things, or it's fish, or it's mollusks, or whatever it may be. And similarly, we tend to think of soil as inert. In fact, we call it dirt. But in fact, soil is a living system. It's filled with all kinds of living organisms, basically, which are helping recycle critical nutrients and make them available to living things once again. So it's time we sort of woke up and looked at all of this planet as being a living system and one we should respect.
Thank you, Dr. Lovejoy. David Foreman has written to and spoken up on behalf of our generation and others yet to come. He is particularly focused on reestablishing viable wild corridors in North America to preserve the diversity of our natural world. Dave?
Most Americans, when they hear the name United States Fish and Wildlife Service, would logically think that it's an agency designed to protect animals, and in some cases they're right. However, for much of its history, the Fish and Wildlife Service's main mission has been to kill animals, and particularly predators and other troublesome species like prairie dogs. During the first half of the 20th century, the Fish and Wildlife Service conducted an extermination campaign to get rid of predators such as wolves, mountain lions, and grizzly bears from the lower 48 states. But in the 1980s and 1990s, with the turnaround in public attitude towards large carnivores, the Fish and Wildlife Service led the effort to recover wolves in the western United States, the wolves indeed that it once killed. And this led to the reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone National Park in 1995. And in Arizona and New Mexico in 1997, the reintroduction in the wild of the lobo, the Mexican wolf, the most endangered carnivore in the world. Dave Parsons, now of the Rewilding Institute, led this effort as the team leader for the Fish and Wildlife Service. But now, under the political commissars of the Bush administration, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has turned to its old ways and is leading a second extinction campaign of lobos in the wild, doing this for a handful of public land ranchers. Right now, violating all the recommendations from conservation biologists and others and their former guidelines, the Fish and Wildlife Service, lack of management, lack of protection, willingness to kill the endangered lobos in the wild if they so much as look at a cow, is leading rapidly to their extermination in the wild. If India mismanaged its tigers in the reprehensible way the United States is managing its lobos, the world would be outraged. If Kenya was mismanaging its lions the way the Federal Wildlife Agency is mismanaging our lobos, there would be an international outcry. And if Spain had a war of elimination against its wolves and against the highly endangered Iberian lynx, there would be outrage all over the world. But the United States is now exterminating the lobo in the southwestern United States. And where is the outrage? Where is the international outcry? Indeed, where is the national outcry? It's an outrage going on now in Arizona and New Mexico for a handful of public lands ranchers, and it's being conducted by our federal government and by the political commissars that the Bush administration has put into the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. I want to encourage listeners to write your member of Congress and your United States senators to protest what has happened with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and to call on Congress to have oversight hearings on the Fish and Wildlife Service's war of extermination against the lobo in the southwestern United States.
Thank you, Dave. You can learn more about Dave Foreman and his work through the Rewilding Institute at rewilding.org. And finally, as always, Emma Sleeth brings her fresh youthful optimism to the stage. Emma?
Last week, in my History of Britain class, my professor was explaining how James II tried to flee from England when William of Orange was advancing on London. His face is on every coin in the country, Dr. McKinley reminds us. His statue is in every town square. He has decreed that he is monarch by the will of God and then made his views on divine monarchy official policy. His is a face every subject of the kingdom should know. Entering into the king's mind, Dr. McKinley mused, let me see. I'll take off my wig and dress in peasant garb, and no one will recognize me. We all laughed. Now class, he continued, that is roughly analogous to, say, Superman putting on glasses. Pulling on and off his own glasses to demonstrate, he sung, now I'm Superman, now I'm not. Now I'm Superman, now I'm not. Where is Superman? I'm not Superman, I'm Clark Kent. As I left class, I found myself still laughing, but the object of my laughter had switched from Superman to myself. I have made myself known as an environmentalist. I talk about creation care everywhere I go. And yet, do my actions live up to my standards? Or am I living a sham double life, not living out my words? Friends, with all due respect, who needs Clark Kent? Let's live the life we speak about every moment of our lives. Let's be Superman 24/7.
Okay, Superman I am, until next week, when we bring you again the Weekly Earth Summit. And now a special program note. If you'd like to add your voice to the Weekly Earth Summit, email me at wildsidenews@cox.net. Speaking of emails, I got an email from an ancient friend and new listener, otherwise known as Deborah, who sent me a link to a fantastic YouTube clip of Snowball, the Dancing Cockatoo. You have to take a look at this. It's fantastic. I put a link to the clip, which is actually posted on the Bird Lovers Only blog, and I want you to take just a moment and imagine Snowball the Dancing Cockatoo. Here's the audio from the video. Be sure to watch, though. I don't know about you, but I know anytime I happen onto America's Funniest Pet Videos, I'm stuck. And what it says to me is, the animals are wildly smart. I saw a clip of a cat, this was just recently, unlocking and opening a sliding glass door. In this modern era, we're giving animals a lot of new challenges in cohabiting in close proximity to we humans in our homes and apartments. And with video, thank God, we are capturing the amazing ingenuity, creativity, passion, emotion, expression, and the phenomenal spirit of so many animals. We humans in the world are in a process of restructuring, trying to adapt to a whole new matrix of truth about ourselves and the living systems. And we all need to do everything we can to be sure that we build in a powerful awareness of the amazing intelligence and joy that individual animals have and share with us every day when we pay attention. Because when we do, we will all begin to build a better, more conscious world. So be sure to watch Snowball the Dancing Cockatoo. I laugh every time I see it. We now head on up to the real Midwest, to Rushford, Minnesota, where we've been following the story of recovery of this small town, hit hard by a major storm system that led to severe flooding. Let's see what's happening. Well, continuing the story from Rushford, Minnesota, the town in southern Minnesota that was so devastated, along with many of the other towns in southern Minnesota and Wisconsin and Iowa, by the floods of mid-August. It's a story about a community, 1,500 people, who suddenly found themselves in a crisis due to natural conditions, unusually heavy rains. And we've been kind of following this story with a local resident there, Donna Buckby, who we talked to literally the night that it was happening, and we've followed through ever since. Donna, I want to talk with you and see how things are progressing in Rushford, Minnesota. Welcome to the Wild Side News again.
Hi. Hello.
Well, it's been almost 2 months.
Yeah.
And the small town in Minnesota, why don't you just give me whatever comes to mind about what the status of this town's recovery is?
Well, everyone's in limbo right now. Well, for the most part, some people are rebuilding their homes. And, well, some people have just turned their backs and walked away without even mucking out their homes. Houses are coming down. There's big gaping holes around town. The houses are gone. But a lot of people are just in limbo. The businesses are in limbo, and people wanting to rebuild their homes are in limbo because of the struggle now between the legislature and the governor and the Department of Employment and Economic Development, which has taken over the doling out of the cash. Cash has not really arrived.
Any easy answer to as why it's not arriving at this point yet?
Well, there's a debate about how to interpret the legislative bill. But the legislature, as they wrote this bill, it was understood that the money was to be given to the local units as a grant and that they could decide to give this out how they saw fit. But then through the governor and the Department of Employment and Economic Development, they have taken over the doling out of the funds. And instead of granting the money, they are requiring loans.
Now, would this be on a community-wide basis or on an individual basis?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I understand, but it would be individual basis.
I mean, for example, if my home was devastated by a flood, would I be applying to the state grant, you know?
You're supposed to go through the small business agency to get this loan, and you might get, depending on the interest rate and the conditions met, like if you stayed in that location for 10 or 12 years, then maybe 50% of your loan will be forgivable. And then other people would have to pay back 75% or 80% of the loan. And that is the business community and the homeowners are saying that this will bankrupt the town. The way they had been given hope early on by our wonderful legislators that this money was going to be a grant. But the state is saying, well, we need to be fair to the rest of the state who have not been given grants during disasters. But Rushford is really kind of unique because this wasn't a tornado people could have had insurance for or other types of disasters that they could have had insurance for. This was a flood, and they aren't considered in a floodplain. And so they were discouraged from or even not allowed to. They weren't even given the option to have flood insurance.
You mentioned that you hadn't been down in Rushford for a couple of weeks.
Well, I haven't been down kind of working really hard down there. Actually, a tree fell on my house. There was a bad storm, and it's really hard to find carpenters who can come and help out here because they're all in town.
Wow.
So, I'm kind of waiting here, too. So I have my own priorities here at home, but I will be going down in Thursday to do some work. And we've been checking in and going to some fundraisers, and we're working on maybe getting the type of registry so people can buy building supplies, kind of like bridal registry.
One of the stories that we kept following was whether at what point the town food store would be up and running. Is that back up and running yet?
Well, you know, the shelves are up, and there's some dry goods on the shelves, and I think they're going to open in a week or so. It's really a gift. And the Hoynes family, they are really taking a big risk to open up again because they don't know what's going to happen to the town. But also, my understanding is that, okay, the owner of the grocery store lost the store, but he also lost his own home. So he had to put up as collateral his two other stores in other towns in the area, and also, I for sure, one of his son's homes and maybe two sons' homes. Hmm. Now, what if business isn't as fast or as good in the months and years ahead? What's going to happen? Everyone recognizes that this man is giving a huge gift to the community, that he's taking a huge risk.
Well, that is the way it is in rural parts of America. There is truly a community. Well, it sounds as if things aren't moving as probably as fast or as smoothly or as with the strength and vigor that people had hoped.
Right, right. They're very disappointed, they're heartbroken, and they're angry.
There are things about life I don't understand, one of them being that it seems as if in terms of these forms of sort of bureaucratic responses or whatever this is called, somehow don't take into account that there's actual real people who are involved, good people. These people didn't bring this on themselves. You were talking about, for example, a home loan. You know, in small towns, there's 87-year-old grandmas who basically have a fixed income. They've owned the home. Now the home is gone. Maybe they didn't have insurance. They don't have an option. Maybe there is an option, but that pretty much is the end of their saga in terms of their home.
That's right. That's right. They're moving in with their children, or they're moving into vacancies at the nursing home.
You have your electricity up and running and the water is back, or how are people dealing with that?
Oh, the water. Well, the electricity is on in most of, a lot of the town. Water is back. People, they say you can drink the water, but I'm having my well tested. I live 6 miles out of town because of the concentration of atrazine and other chemicals that went into the groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
We're all afraid here. But what one of the things that the town discovered when they were pulling these houses down and lifting cement slabs up, that there are over 200 uncapped wells in town. So all that flood soup went down into those open wells.
Oh, that is that's a bad story.
It's a real bad story.
Towns like that rely on wells.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they spent weeks flushing out the city wells,
yeah.
And they had to just keep pouring chlorine down them and keep flushing them out. So I don't know what's going to happen with the drinking water here.
Mm. Now, how about things like in many homes there, I imagine good old-fashioned heating oil is the way people stay warm. People do have to stay warm. Have you had some cold spells yet?
Well, yeah, there have been some cold snaps here, but most of the people, the homes are totally open and gutted, and so no one's living in them. They're staying somewhere else.
Oh, really?
People are panicking because they want to get their homes closed in before the snow comes.
They've got about a week or two.
Well, yeah, I mean, it could happen any time. And, people are really afraid about it. They want to get their homes at least closed in so that they can get heaters in there.
Well, just between you and me, I don't think it's going to happen. I've built a house. I know how long it takes. And particularly if you don't have help, I mean lots of help, you're not going to get that done. And the supplies and then the economics, this doesn't sound very good.
No, it doesn't. We're all really scared.
So what are you going to do about that? How does a person handle that? We're talking about a Midwestern town. There is no more Midwestern than southern Minnesota.
Right.
What's happening to these people? I just, it's hard for me to fathom.
Well, I saw this kind of psychological chart about what happens, and I'm kind of feeling it. Immediately afterward, there's such community cohesion that people are almost elated, especially because no one was killed in Rushford. Although the stories I've heard, it's just amazing that no one was killed. But now, because of this state of limbo and the money not coming and winter coming on, people are getting depressed. And you just, some people are just working right through it, but others are just, well, they're almost, the town feels like it's, some of it is stagnating. I'll tell you, but when that grocery store opens up, that's going to be huge.
Sure it will be.
Yeah. But it's just very depressing right now.
Yeah, it'll be a psychological anchor for people, and they'll feel a sense of stability, and that something is moving along. Well, I heard about this story. That's why I was curious about this. What does happen to a community of 1,500 that is devastated by a flood? Good Midwestern folks, a farm community. One could hope that things went better. I truly imagined and hoped that they would. But based on what you're telling me, it sounds as if this is, you know, becoming, yet we've talked about this before, but this kind of is following the Katrina pattern. Not that it's the same. I don't know that there's people absolutely can't move at all because they can't get the funding. But it just seems as if there's a lack of some sort of unified response that meets the challenge of this community.
Right. I don't understand that either. Why wouldn't we just be able to have if we had to buy insurance then just to cover anything, a flood, fire, tornado, vandalism? Why couldn't we just get that coverage? I don't understand that. Or maybe just that one time in our lives we'd have our homes replaced if there was a catastrophic disaster. But no, I can't understand it myself. Why can't we get this going here? I know our taxes are going to go up. That's fine. It's a privilege to pay taxes. I'm not opposed to that. But to fix the roads, Sydney, the roads in Houston County have been devastated.
You mean because the floods took out pavement and cut through roads and that type of thing?
Yeah, they wiped out a lot of bridges. Houston County has more bridges than any other county in the state.
Hmm.
And so bridges were lost and roads were washed away, and there were a lot of mudslides.
Wow.
It took whole hillsides down over the roads.
Well, Donna Buckby, I had hoped really, truly, that this would be, that there'd be a sense that things are moving along and getting prepared for, I know what winter's like in that part. It isn't fun.
No.
As a matter of fact, you die if you're not prepared. You guys are in a tough state. I hate to say it. You mentioned that you heard some tales of dealing with that flood, you know, since we last talked. Mm-hmm. Any that you care to share?
Well, I met this one woman, this sweet young woman, last fall when we were going door to door for the elections. And I ran into her at a meeting a couple weeks ago, a Habitat for Humanity meeting. Town. And I went up to her after and I said, "Remember me?" And I said, "I definitely remember you and your dear children." And I said, "How did you fare in the flood?" And her face just totally changed. Her eyes got real big and she said that they heard the sirens and then they didn't know what to make of that. And then they heard the bullhorns and people screaming to go to high ground immediately, get out of your homes, get out. And she said, well, she lived in this apartment building. She said the people next door to her left 2 minutes earlier than she did, and they were actually able to get in their cars and drive away. But she said by the time she and her children went out into the hallway, she said it was so eerie, the light was still on, but water was coming up the hallway, first an inch deep, and by the time they got to the front door, it was up to their waist, and by the time they got outside, it was up to their necks in the pouring rain, the dark, and she said there was current and it was swirling and debris, and some of the neighbors on the other side of her were carrying their tiny little infant. And so these people tried to, they were bobbing up and down in the water and trying to find their way to Vinegar Hill. And she said they finally made it to the Vinegar Hill Road, which is a couple blocks away, and they sat there for 5 hours in the rain until someone came in a boat to get them. But it's just, these stories are repeated hundreds of times for this little town, and so people are really traumatized. It's just amazing to think about what they've been through.
That is truly a nightmare.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 They're really in a state of trauma. So they really need help. I mean, they need the money. And I don't understand why. I'm about to cry right now thinking about it. I don't understand why they can't get this money.
I guess it's the state of the world right now. It's as if the problems are so bogged down in some sense that things have to be controlled and run through systems that it doesn't work anymore. It just doesn't work. These people just need help. You know, it's like too bad we don't have a National Guard that's available. That you know, quite honestly, where's the National Guard? Or maybe I shouldn't ask that question.
Well, they were certainly here right after the flood, and thank God for them because they were very helpful. But here's another little kink in the story, is that the man who was appointed, maybe this doesn't have anything to do with it, but the man who was appointed to dole out the money by the governor's office ran for the legislature last fall, and he was not elected. And I'm just hoping that he's not punishing Rushford for not electing. I don't know.
Are other towns faring better than Rushford?
You know, I've been so tapped into Rushford, and I don't know about the other towns. I think if the money isn't here, it isn't in the other places either.
How about FEMA?
Well, the people, in order to get the FEMA money, they have to apply for through the small business agency for loans. And but I think they just have to apply, but then the FEMA will give them 28,000 max. And not everyone's going to get the maximum, but you can hardly haul the trash away for that. You can hardly demolish what needs to be demolished with that amount of money, let alone then to buy new building material.
So there aren't FEMA people on the ground there necessarily?
No, there are FEMA people, and the FEMA trailers. There's a trailer park. There are about 60 trailer homes right now, FEMA trailers. I mean, so FEMA is here.
Okay, good.
Yeah, but business cannot use FEMA. Homeowners can.
Uh-huh. So there are trailers. Well, that's at least good. There's at least trailers there.
Yeah, yeah.
How big are they? 35 foot or, you know, the single trailers come in many sizes. Are they house? Are they more like a long house trailers or are they more like travel trailers?
No, they look like the long house trailers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Are they hooked up and ready to go?
I think they're working on that.
Well, that's a good sign.
I don't know if there are some blocks that are ready and people moving in. I'm not sure yet.
Yeah.
But they are putting the plumbing in.
Well, that's a good sign. At least it means that there's shelter.
Yeah.
Or potentially shelter. And that's the good news.
Yeah.
That at least someone is doing something. Otherwise, the picture was almost as if there was nothing happening. Well, Donna Buckby, is there anything else you want to share at this point about...
Well, just to remind people, if they want to donate to the Rushford Flood Disaster Fund, that they can send it to the City Hall in Rushford, Minnesota, 55971.
If people have stuff, I mean, do people need furniture and clothing?
There have been donations of furniture and clothing, and I think they're holding off with that now because they've got probably too much. Now, see, there is a good thing.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's what I want to find is the story here, because we learn from these things.
Right.
Learn to prepare, number one, but also we learn how to make things better next time it happens, and it's going to happen again. Somewhere, you know, it just happened to be your time.
Yes.
Well, Donna, thanks so much. I know that you're busy. You've got, of all things, a tree. What, a lightning strike that took that?
There was a horrible wind. People have. I was out of town actually. I was in western Minnesota, and. People called and said, well, the worst wind we've ever seen, except once, came and a tree is on our house.
Oh, my.
Yes. So the tree is cut off and it's off, but, I mean, the house has some damage, so it's not that bad. And really, I mean, compared to what everyone else is going through, it's absolutely nothing.
Well, Donna, I'll tell you what. I've got a spare bedroom here. If you need to just get away for a little while, you come on down.
Yeah, well, that's very sweet of you. And likewise, if you come this way, we have room, too.
Okay. Donna Buckby talking to us from Rushford, Minnesota, trying to deal with the flood that hit a couple of months ago. Thanks so much, Donna. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Sydney.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.
I call it global weirding, as parts of our nation are flooding while others are drying up. When we return, we have a special Nature News segment about the dramatic drought that has people in the southeastern U.S. choking on questions of how they may be forced to cope in the very near future. And following that, ever wanted to write about nature? To become part of the emerging teams of journalists and writers who travel and report on and tell the stories of this changing earth? Stay tuned and you'll get a great briefing on what it takes from nature and environmental writer Wendy Holtkamp when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
The suns that fill the sky, I wonder if.
someone in the heavens looking back down on me. I'll never know. So much space to believe, funny when we are small. The moon follows the car. There's no one but you see. Hey, the moon is chasing me. I worried if I looked away, she'd be gone. Don't lose the dreams inside your head. They'll only be there till you're dead. Dream.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Almost everyone, at one time or another, has taken a stab at writing about a walk in the woods, sitting by a stream, thinking about the stars, recording the antics of a wild coyote that showed up in a backyard. We love to capture and interpret the world around us. Some people make a living writing about nature and the environment. In a moment, we talk with Wendy Holtkamp, nature writer and journalist, who is getting ready to help people learn to become professional writers. Get a paper and something to take notes. It's time to start writing, right now. Stay tuned. Want to be a nature writer or environmental journalist? A lot of people think about it. Most people are afraid to really try. But like any skill or profession, you have to learn the basics. In just a moment, we talk with nature writer and environmental journalist Wendy Holtkamp, who will tell you what's involved in getting started in this very hot new writer's market. And you'll learn about an upcoming online workshop she's offering that, as I'm sure you'll hear, can help you succeed. But first, a special edition of this week's Nature News. So now, the news. The southwestern U.S. has felt the effects of what appears to be an emerging drought. Communities which rely on the Colorado River or on snowmelt throughout the summer are talking with one another with a new sense of urgency about how to share the dwindling supply of available water. Los Angeles just asked restaurateurs to only provide water when asked. It's a small but very personal start to what may be the emerging accommodation to the effects of global warming. But recently, reports are coming in from around the southeast, which indicate that a similarly severe drought is being felt fairly quickly throughout the region. We begin with a brief news summary, then read from a selection of reactions to the story originally posted on the MSNBC webpage by readers. News is news, we hear a lot of it, but eyewitness accounts reveal the true feelings of those who are living with the new truth that water is becoming increasingly scarce. First, the story. It's been a dry summer in the southeastern U.S., which traditionally had to endure a series of summer tropical storms and an occasional hurricane. But this year, the area has been spared of storms, and a new storm is rising that eclipses the hardships of fierce storms and hurricanes, because without them, lakes are drying up, fishing holes are gone dry, frogs are disappearing, businesses are closing, and whole communities are wondering, what happens next? The area has seen an explosion of new development and significant increases in population in Georgia, Tennessee, the Carolinas, and Kentucky. Officials are now admitting that if the water shortages continue, the area will not have the water needed to supply the population. And here is what people who live in that area have posted in the last 24 hours to this emerging story. Senseless says, "The lake I live on, in the Panhandle, is down about 20 inches. Brevard in North Carolina. One thing you failed to mention about the drought in the southeast, many areas are in forested mountains, and there is the added danger of forest fires. Here in the Appalachians of North Carolina, the native shrubs, rhododendrons, azaleas, and mountain laurels are shriveling up too. It is a very sad thing. Slats, who is from Tennessee, writes, "As a Tennessee Valley citizen, we are worried. I live between two large impoundments, Cherokee on one side and Douglas on the other. We're seeing parts of the lake not seen since it was flooded over 50 years ago, and it is the opposite of the year it spilled over the sluice gates and had to be let out. First times for both, feast and famine, and all in less than two decades. It's slim around here, the water falling from the sky. Can't remember when we had any rain. And if we don't get a wet winter, we'll all be carrying water in from elsewhere. And soon." Not really, but it is beyond serious. I can smell the fear when the spigot quits working and the switch doesn't turn the lights on anymore. I just know this, then, now, and future. We need to conserve. We've grown all fat and sassy, using and consuming without a thought to tomorrow. Well, ladies and gents, tomorrow is upon us, and it's right here, right now. Pogo said, "I have met the enemy, and it is us. It's past time. We leave a little for the next day and time, and put back what we have taken. It doesn't really take much. Just think about conservation, conservation, conservation. Put those dollars back in the bank, and watch your utility bills, among others, go on a diet too. I may be a hillbilly, but even a dog knows better than to mess up his own backyard." Tim in Alpharetta, Georgia says, "I live in Alpharetta, Georgia, just north of Atlanta. I used to have a spring-fed pond in my backyard, quite a large pond, larger than my house, but it completely dried up about 2 years ago. It would get about half full during winter rains and has been dry since March of this year. My fish died, my frogs died, my water lilies of 18 years died. So, what do I do now? Add boulders and yucca plants? I don't know how to plan my gardening anymore. Should I dig a well? A really deep well?" Brian in Virginia says, "We too are in dire straits due to lack of rain. My county here in Virginia and others nearby have not had a significant drop of rain in over 30 days, and very little before that. We are now down to double-digit days left of water in our reservoir. We are currently on mandatory restrictions, and those may need to be revised even stricter in the coming days and weeks. Although conservation and restrictions help, without any rainfall, steady, not rain, not thunderstorms, we will need to try and purchase water from neighbors that may not be in the same perils as we are. I, too, see development accruing around the county with no reflection as to how they plan to water the new lawns that come with the new houses. Maybe it is a wake-up call to all of us. The earth's resources aren't bottomless after all." David, "I live in Montgomery, Alabama. Normally a place that experiences plentiful rainfall, we have not had a wet weather front move through in a long time. Lake Martin and Lake Jordan have very low water levels, and plants are dying from lack of rainfall. Our situation is critical. Too bad the judges have declared God dead. Praying in schools doesn't seem quite so extreme now." Judy of Stopover, Kentucky writes, "All the creeks are drying up in eastern Kentucky. Even the mighty Tug River is so low you can wade across." Those are comments in the last 24 hours about the drought in the southeastern U.S. We'll be following this story in the weeks and months ahead. It just seems there's a cumulative story emerging, one that we need to hear more about. And maybe that's a perfect segue into our next feature, because perhaps you are someone who can write or learn to write and help tell these stories. Nature and environmental writers are needed now more than ever. So to help get you thinking about this part or full-time career, we now head on down to Houston, Texas. All of us at some time or other have gone out, taken a walk in the woods or along a seashore or just in our own backyard, and been observing nature and watching things, and something has caught our attention. And there's this unique instinct. It's like a reaction. It's the human desire to write, to capture these moments. And it goes back a long, long ways, writing about nature. Certainly one of the greatest influences in me becoming a naturalist was about probably the 7th grade or 6th grade when I was reading Henry David Thoreau, and he was talking about the War of the Ants. And as someone who had always been intrigued with nature, I suddenly found someone speaking my voice, my thoughts, who was a very successful and honored part of American history, and I suddenly felt like I was part of a real world. This was a voice that was speaking for me. Really, America is very much defined by its nature writers, and it's a grand tradition. And it continues, and now as we move into the 21st century, nature writing is in many respects morphing and expanding into environmental writing, and we need it now more than ever. Well, joining me now from Houston, Texas, is a very successful nature and environmental author and writer, Wendy Holtkamp. Wendy, we've talked before. Welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Wendy, first of all, because Houston has been in the news because of weather and things, how are things weather-wise down in Houston?
It's drizzling today, but it's going away. So, yeah, there's been a lot of rain this fall. It's been pretty crazy.
Yeah. Well, you're an interesting person. You have a very interesting website at wendyholtkamp.com. That's WendeeHoltkamp.com. You're a writer, a photographer, and also bohemian. And I find that very intriguing because I consider myself a bit of a bohemian myself. But you have a great way of kind of defining what it means to be a bohemian. Tell us what you can about that, and then we'll get into more of the writing and environmental writing.
Well, my dad was a hippie, and so I don't necessarily associate myself with the hippie movement per se, even though I was raised by a dad who was a hippie. And so the bohemian title just kind of spoke to me because it's sort of like an intellectual hippie, somebody who can live in that world, who's progressive and a thinker. So I think I just like that title, and I like to throw it into my freelance writer, photographer, bohemian, because it's a little bit different. It makes me stand out from the crowd.
You run your own path. You're not necessarily concerned about how the world interprets you, and I think that's what makes a person become at least a fledgling bohemian.
Right. Yeah, I think it's important to follow your own path, to listen to your own wisdom as well as the wisdom of spiritual traditions. I myself am both a Christian and a scientist, but one who does not necessarily fall under the fundamentalist or right-wing conservative category. So I sort of don't really fit into any box because I don't necessarily fall in line with, you know, the liberals always or the Christians always or the scientists always. So sometimes it's hard to live according to this type of, but it's really what we all have to do. We all have to find our own path and not just listen to our own wisdom, but listen to both our own wisdom and the wisdom of others and just continue to learn as we go on through life. So,
because I like to write, words and phrases keep coming into my mind, and you inspired me to think of the phrase an intellectual gypsy. I kind of like that.
I like that.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to mention about the bohemian title is my name, Wendy, actually, you might be familiar with it from Peter Pan, but the word means to wend or to wind, and so also wanderer. And so that really fits my life because particularly in the past couple of years, I've really started traveling around the world and writing about, you know, I've been to the Peruvian Amazon and the Galapagos and, you know, all around the United States. And so I tie this into my bohemian roots because I'm both writing and I'm learning about different science and ecological field research projects and then writing about it and bringing the knowledge of these projects to people here in the United States that may not be familiar with what's going on in different corners of the world. So that kind of feeds into both the writing and the, you know, the bohemian title.
Great opportunity to live out your dream.
Yes.
A lot of hard work, though. And that's kind of what we're going to talk about a little bit, is this concept of becoming a writer, both nature and environmental writer. And you're a very successful writer. You've had over 100 articles published in some leading journals, including Audubon and Sierra Magazine and Discovery Channel. That takes a lot of work to be able to penetrate at that level. And I'd like to explore that a little bit in terms of what it takes to become a successful writer. That means to be published. Virtually everybody can go out and write, and we could talk about that. But I really would like to talk about more those people who have an inclination to do something with their writing. And I thought we might just go over some of the things that you think are most important. And maybe we'll start out with just what leads to someone becoming a better nature and environmental writer.
That's a good question. I think, you know, my background is I'm a scientist. I wasn't trained as a journalist. And so that's kind of a little bit different from a lot of people's path to become a writer. But I don't think you have to be a scientist to be a good scientific or environmental journalist. That's just my particular path. But it is very helpful if you are a specialist, if you sort of have a niche. You take a topic that you're particularly passionate about, and you learn as much as you can about it, and then you write about it, particularly if you're starting out and you want to get published. If you start out and you've been in community activism for some time and you can write about a topic with a particular voice, that helps you get published with that. And then once you publish a few articles, it's a lot easier to then break into other magazines. But you have to start out, it's sort of the chicken and the egg problem. You know, you want to become published, but you don't have any what they call clips, which are published articles to send to editors. So you've kind of got to get beyond that. And so that's the new writer's dilemma, is how to get published.
Talk a little bit about length of articles and sort of how you approach knowing the right length for a particular market. We'll cover some of these topics just briefly. And ultimately, I should mention to listeners that Wendy does offer an online writing course, and we'll talk about that at the end of the interview here for people who wish to utilize her expertise. But in terms of defining how many pages of typewritten text, double-spaced, do you think in terms of articles these days?
That's a good question. It really depends. When you're starting out, you want to, it's a lot easier to get published writing what are called news briefs. The front of the magazine, sometimes they call it the front of the book, they have a lot of, you know, timely news articles, and those are usually between 250 and 500 words. You know, they're very short pieces, but that's what most new writers have to write. So you don't start out thinking, okay, I want to write a little 250-word piece, but that's really what you have to do. The alternative is to write an essay, and unlike most articles where you typically don't write an article and then submit it because you never know if a magazine's going to want to publish that, essays are an exception. An essay is personal, it's got a theme, it's got you in it, and so that's a way that you can get published as a new writer. Unfortunately, you have to write it and you have no idea if anyone's going to publish it, but if you're familiar with the magazine that you're sending it to, you know, you try to fit it into their particular, you know, if they have an essay that touches on something with the weather. I know Audubon has an essay department that regularly covers some aspect of the weather, but it's a personal column, it's a personal essay, so you could submit that essay. Well, that's a difficult way to get published, just sending in an essay blind, but sometimes when you're starting out, you have to do that.
Let's get back to news briefs. If a person has news briefs, what do you do with those? Do you just send them out cold, or do you have to use some sort of query system, or what's the best way to go about that?
Right. If you would always want to send a query, unless you're sending an essay. With an essay, you don't typically query. You just write the whole essay. If you want to get published and you're trying to break into a new magazine, into their section, the front of the book section that's got their news pieces, you would send a query, and sometimes the query is as long as the article.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things, and there's an art in itself to writing query letters. It's actually sometimes the hardest writing that you can do because you have to not only really peg your idea, make it interesting, catch the editor's attention, you also have to say what you're going to cover in the entire article, who you're going to interview, and then a little bit about your background.
Fairly, this is the pitch.
Yes, it's the pitch letter or the query letter, and you... For a news brief, it doesn't have to be too long because the article itself is not going to be very long. If you're pitching a longer article, a feature, or a department-length piece, you talked about the various lengths of articles. Well,
There's news briefs, which I mentioned are 250 to 500 words approximately. You've got columns or department-length articles. Those are usually 1,200 words. And you asked about page length. I'm not really sure. I just count the words.
Yeah.
And then a feature, really, it depends on the magazine because every magazine is different. But these days, most environmental magazine features are between 1,200 and 3,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
Gone are the days when you had the National Geographic features that were something like 70,000 words.
But
you actually, there are a few magazines like the New York Times Magazine that, you know, Atlantic Monthly that still have some of the really longer features.
Let's talk a little bit about finding markets. What would you recommend in terms of helping people locate a broader spectrum of opportunity?
Right. Well, I just recommend that prospective writers go to a bookstore, go to a big Barnes & Noble or Borders that has hundreds of magazines and just thumb through them. See what catches your eye because everybody has their own unique sub-interest. If maybe you're into outdoor adventure sports or maybe you are more into the literary type writing, or maybe you are into nature photography. You can take nature writing or environmental writing in so many different directions. You can write, and because the environment is sort of becoming a trend now,
it is.
You can write for a lot of the mainstream magazines. There's in-flight magazines. There's, you know, there's obviously travel magazines. There's really a wide range of magazines that people can write for.
Can you submit to a variety of publishers at the same time?
That's a good question. When you're starting out, most likely it's going to be harder for somebody to really, you know, land a query. So when I started out, I would take one query, and I'd send it to several different magazines at the same time. But the problem, once you become published, you tend not to want to do that because you kind of know magazines like to have some sort of exclusivity. So
yes.
If you send an idea to one magazine and they buy it while the other one's waiting and the other one comes back to you and says, hey, I want that article, you have to say, wait a minute, I already sold it. They don't usually like that very much. So I tend to just send an idea out to one magazine now, wait till they get back to you.
How long does that usually take?
Well, it depends. If you're starting out, it can take, you know, and they don't know you from Adam, it can take 6 weeks. I email all my queries these days. I don't use the snail mail anymore. But if I don't hear back from an editor within 3 or 4 weeks, I usually send a follow-up email. And I include the original query so they don't have to dig back through their email to make sure they got it. And if you know an editor, most of the editors I work with now I have a relationship with. They know who I am. And so usually sometimes they'll get back to me within a couple of days, sometimes a couple of weeks. But it's usually a lot faster.
So you've sent out the query and some publisher comes back to you and says, yes, we're interested in this. What happens next?
Okay, well, typically a magazine has their basic pay scale, and it's not going to range too far above that or too far below that. They'll usually start you out at a little bit lower than average because they want you to prove that you can write, that you can turn in the article on time, and that you're relatively easy to work with. Those are the three main things that I tell writers they need to do. And so once you've maybe done one article for them, then they'll usually raise their pay rate or maybe after a while. But it's not going to range too much for a magazine because a magazine has a particular budget. You've got your higher paying ones and you've got your lower paying ones. But yes, when you first get an article accepted, you'll say, okay, well, how much do you pay? And they either come back at you with a, you know, I pay $1 a word or we pay 50 cents a word. And then you say, okay, that sounds acceptable. And then you kind of can negotiate things like your contract, your rights, the rights that they're going to purchase from you.
Also, what kind of lead time do most of these editors look at in terms of articles? How far in advance do you have to pitch a feature that may have a time stamp on it?
Oh, gosh. It really varies, again, for which publications. So I write for magazines. The magazines usually are working anywhere from 3 months to 9 months ahead. So if you're, let's say right now it's October, they're probably working on spring issues right now. So if you're doing something about weather and you're wanting to write about winter, well, it's almost too late because they're working on the spring.
That's important to know, isn't it?
Definitely. However, if you're writing for newspapers, they have a lot shorter lead time, so they're working on a lot shorter of a deadline. And so if you want to write about something winter skiing, right now is still an okay time to pitch those kind of articles.
And then do they pay, I know it varies, but I'm just trying to get a kind of an overview here. Do they typically pay upon completion or publication?
Ooh, again, it really varies by the magazine. The journalistic standard would be paying on acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
That's what most of us who do this for a living, you know, I won't write for very many publications that pay on publication. There are a couple here and there because I know they will pay. But generally, you want to get a magazine that's going to pay on acceptance. After they've accepted your article and you've turned it in, then they send you a check.
Mm-hmm. Now, so you write the article, and then what about editorial rights? They can edit you. You have some sort of right. How is that negotiated?
That's a good question. Basically, you turn in an article, and sometimes you'll never see it again until it's published. Well, I prefer, because I'm very particular about it, I want my articles to be very accurate. And sometimes an editor can accidentally, you know, just change a couple of words, and it can really change the meaning of something. So I like to take a look at the article before it goes to press, and usually most editors will let me look at the article. So that's how that works.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of the basics, and eventually you get your check and you get published and you have yourself a clip, and then you can go from there. There's a lot to this, and obviously you cover all this in your course, which I'm sure a lot of people would love to be able to participate in. We'll talk about that in a little bit. How long have you been writing in this genre?
I've been writing for 12 years now.
I have to imagine that over this time you've seen some changes in terms of what editors are looking for, or style or intro. What can you tell us about that?
Gosh, I wouldn't say that I've necessarily seen really too much of a change in what editors are looking for. It seems like the environment is sort of becoming a trend in the last couple of years, but as far as, you know, I'm writing for environmental publications, which I have been from when I started out, they haven't changed too much. I would say, you know, they're still looking for good writing, original ideas, and a writer that, you know, is easy to work with and is not going to cause a fuss when they change little slight things in the writing.
Okay, pretty standard. I know that, for example, for a while there, the story, the seemed almost the messaging was a lot about the almost an apocalyptic sense of the future in terms of global warming. Now it's changing. There seems to be a different voice that is morphing into more of a let's get something done, let's unite, make things happen, let's work towards a sustainable future. It's much more acceptable to talk about positive things. This is my own observation as I'm in the media myself that I've observed through time. Any thoughts about that?
That's really interesting observation. I guess with global warming, there were so many apparent skeptics. I really don't think in the scientific community there was as much skepticism as the mainstream media made it sound like. But now that there's been sort of a sea change and pretty much the mainstream community has accepted things like global warming, yeah, it makes sense that the tide has turned and people are now like, okay, what can we do about this? How can we change this? How can we stem the tide of what could be in the future?
I know for myself and my messaging, I've had to kind of move away, and I'm glad to do so, of kind of giving warnings and trying to alert people to, and it's much more exciting right now, to talk about what can be done. Mm-hmm. But there's both sides. But we're also, for example, in the show last week, I was talking about the fact that the polar ice caps are really melting much faster than people thought. That's a real story, but it's very important for us to stay aware of.
Right. One thing I've always liked to do with my articles is solution-based. I mean, it's important to sound the warning call, but it doesn't do as much good if you just say, okay, the sky is falling, but what can I do about it? What can you do about it? That kind of, I like to highlight organizations and people that are actually making a difference, that are not just raising the warning call, but they're saying, okay, but I'm doing this, or you can do this. Because ultimately, solutions, you know, they make us feel, you know, it's positive, and I like to focus on those kind of stories that have a take-home message to them.
I'm glad we've made that change. Now let's go back to kind of the basics here. So now that we have the fundamentals and techniques of potentially being published, let's go back to how you actually then craft the story. I know that you like to talk about observational skills and keeping diaries. Tell us a little bit about the importance of that and why you think it is important.
Oh, yeah. One of the first things that I have students do is to keep an observation journal, and that's just a journal that you go outside and you sit in the place, whether it's your backyard or a park, and you just observe the exact same spot day in and day out, or week in and week out, because it's a challenge to look at a place that you've seen over and over and describe it in a new way. And I think that it's really important for nature riders in particular, for any rider, to be able to really observe, to observe the people, to be able to describe the site, so that, you know, the best riding is when you're reading it and you feel like you were there. Well, how do you get to be a writer that can write that way? It requires being a good observer, being able to write about all of your senses. What are you smelling? What are you seeing? What are you hearing? What colors are there? What are the texture? And not only that, but how does it make you feel? What kind of thoughts are coming into your head? And because it's amazing what our mind will connect to a particular observation. We see a spider. Do we feel fear? Do we feel awe? And just to bring all these thoughts into our journal, when we're just free-form writing without our internal editor, then, you know, you can really get into the groove. And I think doing that exercise really improves everybody's writing if you want to be a published writer. So.
I know for myself, one of the things that I've learned is that oftentimes you'll have almost a fear about approaching a writing subject because you feel like you're not prepared to write about it. You've done research, you've thought about it, you've gone out and, you know, kind of experienced something, and you can sit around for days or weeks or months or years thinking, gosh, I need to write that article. And then I've always found this little magic moment where the moment that you actually sit down to write, it opens up a whole arena of information that you really couldn't quite grasp. This is my experience, and I've talked with other writers that it kind of works the same way. So perhaps part of the important message is write.
Yeah, just sit down and do it. It's sometimes I'm the same way. I'll do all the research, I'll do all the interviews, and I get a sort of mental block. I can't do this. Can I do it again? Can I make that magic happen on the paper? But it is, you just sit down, and I heard a quote, I'm not sure who this is, but I was paraphrasing, and it was, you know, that the difference between a professional and somebody who just, you know, writes, who's an amateur, is that the professional has to write. You don't have the option of not doing it. You've got a deadline. You sit down and you do it, even when you don't feel like it. So, and when you do that, the words just come. It comes, and you just write a, you know, as Anne Lamott calls it, I won't say the word, but a crappy first draft.
Yes.
After that, then you go back and you edit it if you need to. You get feedback from others on critique groups, and you just always work to improve the writing and to make it better. And hopefully after you do it long enough, it'll kind of become second nature.
For myself, I find very often I sit, and the most difficult thing is that first line. I'm trying to find that hook, that entry point. What's your experience? What do you advise people? What have you learned from writers yourself as you've taught so many different people? Is that a challenge for others as it is for me?
Oh, yes, the hardest part is writing the lead. That is absolutely without fail. But if you, like you said, if you have the angle of your story, there are two different things, really. There's the lead that you're going to start your article with, and that can be really, really hard to sit down on paper. But if you know the hook, if you basically know how you're going to approach the story, then writing the lead can be easier. And one of the tools that I teach students in my class is called topic spoking. You can have a topic such as dolphins in Galveston Bay, and that's really just a topic. It's not an angle. But then you take that topic and you do this. It's like a wheel. You come up with all the different ways that you could write about that story. You know, a profile on an interesting biologist who's studying dolphin behavior, or how the dolphins use the shrimp, you know, feed next to shrimp boats. Or a personal essay about, how, you know, relating the history of dolphin watching in ancient Greece. You know, there's a million different ideas that you could write about one topic. But so once you formulated your particular angle for your story and you know it, if you can put it into a title and a little subtitle, because you'll see these in most magazines have a title for a magazine article, and then right underneath they have a little tagline. If you can write that for your article and you know what you're going to approach it, pretend like you're the editor writing the little cover blurb that's going to be associated with your article, then you've really got a good start, and then you can write your lead because you basically know how you're approaching it.
It's interesting how that title and subtitle actually put a spin, put a dimension to it. Otherwise, it's a little flat. You're right. Yeah. Good observation. How important or how challenging or dangerous is it to run your writing by friends and family and others?
Oh, I don't think it's dangerous at all. I think I'm on a critique group that I've always been. I tell, it doesn't matter how many years you've been writing and publishing, everybody can always improve their craft. If you want to continue to move on up until you're the best-selling author, a Pulitzer Prize winner, you can always improve your craft because nobody has ever arrived. You know, even until I've been on the Oprah show, then I will have arrived. But I can always improve my craft. There's always work that I need to do to make it better, and I think it's important for everybody to be open to criticism, particularly when you're starting out. You may be sensitive. You don't want somebody to rip into your writing and, you know, make you cower back and be like, oh, I can never show this to anybody. You have to both have sort of this core strength that take people's criticism with a grain of salt, but find the group of people who are going to support you in your endeavor to become a published writer, but also who will give you honest feedback on how you can improve it.
Wendy, you're such a straight-talking person. It's really refreshing. The information that you're providing is just so direct and so to the point. It's always great talking with you, and I just appreciate that. And we're going to talk about your workshop coming up, but you're also going to take a little adventure here, which is probably where you get some of your inspiration. I hear you're heading out of the country.
Yes, I'm going to Nepal in a couple of weeks now. I'm very excited.
Have you been there before?
I've never been there before. It's my goal to go to every continent within the next 5 years, and so within the past year, I guess, I've been to South America and Australia, and now I'm going to Asia. So
I have to imagine you're going to approach this from a writer's and photographer's perspective.
Right. I'm going on assignment for a particular magazine. I'm writing about red panda, which are an endangered species. And, of course, I'm sure once I'm there, I'm going to come up with a million different story ideas. Mm-hmm. But it's always good to go on assignment, because then you know... You know, this is a tax-deductible trip.
That's a really wonderful thing, is you become a professional writer, and these trips are tax-deductible. This is called a business expense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, I'm just curious, in this case, did this come about through a query, or did someone who knows you approach you and ask you to do this?
Yes, it came about through a query, but for a magazine that I write for, you know, I've written for several times.
Wendy, you also offer a wonderful online course. Give people some details on how they can follow up and contact you and see if it's appropriate and hopefully sign up.
Sure. I have a 6-week online writing class. I believe the next one starts November 24th, and it runs for 6 weeks. And I cover all these topics ranging from writing and how to improve your writing to how to know a Nature magazine or an environmental magazine through and through, so that when you pitch them, the editor knows that you're familiar with the magazine, and then how to come up with ideas, and how to develop a query. And one of the things that I offer in the class is Q&As or interviews, in-depth interviews with about 20 different magazine editors, from Audubon, Smithsonian, Sierra Magazine, and the Environmental Magazine, so that you can know what these editors are looking for.
Now, are these live, or are they pre-recorded? How do you do that?
They're actually Q&A, so it's just a printed interview with this editor. There's 10 questions, and, you know, the students come up with the questions, but I already have them from all the past classes. And usually in every class, if there's a particular interest in a magazine, I'll then approach that editor. If it's an editor of a magazine that I don't have a Q&A yet for, I'll say, hey, you know, Mr. Editor, Ms. Editor, are you willing to do a Q&A, because the student is interested? So I'm always expanding the number of interviews that I have for the class, but all the previous ones are available to any student that signs up.
Mm-hmm. And what's the process of signing up?
You go to my website, which is wendyholtkamp.com, as you mentioned. It's wendyholtkamp.com, and you'll see a link for Do What You Love, Learn How to Write and Get Published, and there's, you know, a PayPal link on there. There's information on how to sign up on there.
Wendy, it's always good talking with you. One of these days, it would be fun to talk with you about one of your topics, though, something that you write about. That would be really exciting. Maybe when you get back from Nepal and you have some things that you've worked on, we might talk again. Safe journey.
Thank you.
We'll talk again soon. Wendy Holtkamp, you can find out more about her at www.wendyholtkamp.com. Wendy, thanks a lot.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Lying on the roof, counting suns that fill the sky, I wonder if...
If you are a writer, beginning or advanced, I'm happy to bring your stories to life here on the Wild Side News. Send me a brief email with a short feature, and if it's appropriate, I'll make it a part of one of our shows. You can contact me at wildsidenews@cox.net. time to put a wrap on this one. So, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Thursday or anytime on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world here on the Wild Side News.